Lux Occult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
Whispers, twisting threads, helix spinning, spinning, and the screw shakes loose. He falls first forward, then to his side. He is spilling his power into the sea, currents of hydraulic ichor twirling in the tides. Now rusted and decayed, the once terrifying tyrant is the beached home of shore birds and shy crabs, peppered in places by patches of grasses precocious enough to bear the salted air. The Sardinians still grin, and the silent sisters who have penetrated the final mystery and walked back from the shore still meet to witness the giants twitching in spasms of a death denied. You see, it was only ever barely alive. That is Barely Alive by Sally Forth. Hello and welcome to another episode of Lux Occult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics, exploring the intersections of magic, art, science, philosophy, technology, and more. This is occultism for everyone. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice right now, that means that this show, and magic, for that matter, are for you, if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice within your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree sometimes. Have we ever learned anything if we all agreed all the time after all? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am willing to revise my opinions based on new evidence. Alright, I am so stoked to be presenting today's episode to you all today. I spoke with author Phil Hine about two new collections of essays he has out, Queering Occultures and Acts of Magical Resistance. Like his other stuff, I found both of these to be really enjoyable. There's a lot of cool stuff packed into both of them. Sometimes a book can be, I don't know, like a TARDIS, bigger on the inside in a way that leads off into all sorts of avenues of possibilities, and Phil's books often hit this way for me. And one of the many topics discussed here today is a re-examination of the god Pan, thoughts about queering tantras, the deity at Hardnarishvara, and contextualizing gender when encountering deities from other cultures, the famous Crossbones graveyard and queering sacred spaces, the British subculture dialect, Polari. Phil teaches me some new words, which was pretty fun. We talk about some ways that people have used magic for political activism in the past, and much, much more. So Phil's been someone who in the past has been pretty vocal about calling out some of the bullshit that we see in occult circles in ways which I think were pretty humorous, which I think also, it's good to point out, can be a pretty effective tactic, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. I find Phil's stuff to have a nice sense of, I don't know, earnest authenticity about it, sorely lacking in a lot of other books about occultism or spirituality, so it was really awesome to get the chance to speak with him. I love what I do. Speaking of which, before we get into it here, I'd like to say thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you taking the time to hang out. I'm very lucky to have such awesome listeners, co-conspirators, what have you. You all are so cool. I wasn't sure if anybody would be willing to play along with the silly cryptography poetry contest I devised, But you all have not disappointed in the least and have sent in some very fun stuff. This contest will be going on until the end of August in the year of Our Lady 2023, and winners will be announced in October. So if you like puzzles and poetry, check out the Lux Occult Pod Instagram page for details about that. If you have thoughts, ideas, revelations, etc. that you would like to share for the listener mail segment, send them to me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or at luxoccultpod on Instagram. If you like the show and the other work I've been doing, you can support it on Patreon. If you do so, you can take a bibliomancy break with me. And there are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. Buy me a coffee is an option for those who wish to show their support but do not wish to do the whole Patreon thing. So even $1 a month does add up, and there are costs associated with making this thing. So thank you so much to everybody who is making this show possible by showing their support. Thank you. I'll be back later to give you a Green Mushroom update and some programming notes. Speaking of which, this episode will be a bit of a departure in terms of formatting. I like to mix it up here, as you know. But not to fret, all of the regular features will either be present here or returning in the next episode. After the interview, I'll share a few thoughts about the subversive power of laughter, as well as the notion of turning the other cheek, which, believe it or not, is not a reference to spanking, but is in fact from the Bible. But now, allow me to set the table for you by reading a bit of the descriptions from the very timely collections that Phil Hine and I will be talking about today. Okay, so this is a bit of a description of the collection Queering Occultures by Phil Hine. The occult is queer. Historically, intrinsically, radically, wonderfully queer. Yet at times, this essential fact can feel unacknowledged in wider occulture dialogues. Addressing this, Phil Hine's Queering Occultures is a collection of queer-themed essays exploring, questioning, and reflecting on the diverse trajectories that might arise from applying queer questioning to occultural themes and practices. Drawing on perspectives from queer theory, history, continental philosophy, and shared experience, Hine explores subjects as diverse as shamanism and gender variance, the rise of queer pagan approaches, the uncomfortable history of occult homophobia, queer perspectives on tantra, pan, sacred spaces, and Crowley and Boy Berlin. This far-reaching, necessary book is both a celebratory resistance text and indispensable investigation of the queer in a culture. All right, so fuck yeah. And I will now read you a description of Acts of Magical Resistance. Acts of Magical Resistance is a celebration of the subversive power of enchantment, an inspiring call to action. It offers vital insights into mass rituals, the psychology of effectively countering institutions, and the liberation that comes from carving space for wonder. Addressing not only the often occulted history of the subject, but also the practicalities of magical activism and ritual routes to resistance, Phil Hine has delivered a timely and powerful guide on a key area of occulture. Drawing from the intimate personal involvement of himself and others in magical resistance across 4 decades, Hine explores a diverse range of techniques and approaches to resist oppression and achieve change. All right, fuck yeah. So excited to share my conversation with Phil Hine with you all. So now, without further ado, let's get into it. Well, my guest today is Phil Hine. Phil, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just had a launch in London for the book Queering Occultures.
All right, fantastic. So can you tell me a little bit about Queering Occultures?
Okay, well, this is a collection I put together of essays that deal with various facets of, if you like, what happens when we put the terms queer and occulture together. And rather than trying to come up with something definitive, what I prefer to do is to play around with the edges of those concepts. So if you want to take the title Queering, it's a way of, if you like, applying a queer theory perspective to occultural concepts. And in some ways applying a cultural concept to what it means to be queer, or the queer experience, if you like.
Okay.
This very much arises out of my own experience as a out queer man, which I have been since the late 80s in British culture. And I've been writing on, if you like, on queer related issues almost since then. So the book is kind of autobiographical in places, but also I'm exploring a variety of themes and concepts which have interested me over the years.
Fantastic. And it's a great read. I've checked it out. And yeah, I'm so excited for the listeners to get a look at it, because there's a lot of good stuff in there. If you wouldn't mind sharing a couple anecdotes about what it was like, you know, being a queer man in the late 80s and early 90s in the UK occult scene.
Well, it was interesting, let's say. There was a lot of, if you like, quite homophobic theories being batted about as to why anybody who wasn't heterosexual shouldn't be a magician or a witch. And it was right across the board. I encountered it amongst some of the Wiccans I was involved with, because I was in Wiccan covens for several years, amongst ceremonial magicians, you know, various other practitioners. There was a wide variety of if you like, theories as to why non-heterosexual people shouldn't be involved in the occult, ranging from things like, oh, you know, polarity, you know, everything has to be male and female, and obviously queer people don't fall within that. Also theories about reverse kundalini, block chakras, you name it, really. And these ideas tend to be trotted out quite unthinkingly. And I very much had the feeling that a lot of the people who were coming out with this stuff had just never considered or been around anybody who wasn't, you know, completely heterosexual. I mean, to give you one example, I was in a Wiccan coven in the late 70s and early 80s. I was not very sure of myself, and I kind of like struggling with my, if you like, my sexual identity. And the high priestess of that coven told me quite boldly, you know, if you're not heterosexual, you can't be a witch.
That's absurd. I mean, obviously absurd,
yeah.
Right? But
yeah.
Like,
it sounds laughable nowadays, but that was not an unusual attitude. Give you another example. I'd met a ceremonial magician in the, when would this be? Around about 1986, something like that. And this guy was quite a well-known author of the time. I'm not going to out him, because he was very much closeted. And he said to me, well, I do workshops. You know, I do workshops on ceremonial magic. And my audience are mostly young men. And if they find out I'm gay, then they won't come to my workshops. So that's the reason why he never, you know, came out or mentioned anything to do with sexuality in any of his books. Even back then, I was interested in doing some kind of publication project about, if you like, queer occultism. And he said to me, well, the formal gay presses won't touch it with a barge pole. None of the occult presses will touch it either. So he said, I don't think you should even bother, you know. And again, that's a reflection of how, if you like, how rare out queer people were in the British occult scene at the time. Another example, slightly weirder. I went to a conference in London in the mid-90s, and it was very much, again, oriented towards ceremonial magic, and there'd be people there doing talks on Thelema and the work of Kenneth Grant. And afterwards, I was in a pub, and I started talking to this guy, and he was going on about sexual magic in very much in Crowley's language. And he turned around and said to me, oh, the double solar current must be really powerful. And I thought, what is he on about? The double solar current, you know. And eventually it dawned on me, he was basically talking about men having sex together. And I made some very blunt comment like, oh, well, do you want shag, is that it? And he went, oh no, it would have to be a magical act. I'm not interested in sex with men. You know, as two men getting it together, it would have to be a magical act. And I was kind of like, right, bye.
Okay.
I've had a thing, you know.
Okay.
Because it just seemed to me that this guy was like, I'm prepared to have sex with another man, but it's not really sex, it's a magical act, like putting it in a little safe box, mm-hmm, kind of thing. which I just really wasn't up for, you know. I wasn't kind of that desperate. So does that suffice as far as anecdotes go?
Yeah, thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I think, yeah, just I think that nowadays there is so much intersection between things like paganism and pride and queerness and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, things have moved on a great deal
exactly.
since that time.
Luckily. And so I'm wondering, when do you think that starts to shift sort of in the history of all this?
Well, we were discussing this at the book launch last week, actually. And I think there are several strands involved. One is the rise of, if you like, goddess feminism in Britain, which started in around about, it really starts about 1982 with the protest camp at Greenham Common, which is something I talk about briefly in my other book we're going to discuss, Acts of Magical Resistance.
Yes.
Goddess feminism started to get really popular around the mid-80s, I would say about 86, 87. And that feminist critique of, if you like, mainstream paganism, I think started to shift people's attitudes. I remember Starhawk's work becoming really popular around that time as well. That's one factor. I think another factor is that more and more queer people started to pop up and like myself, were like objecting, if you like, to the thoughtless homophobia that was very much around at the time. And people had to, if you like, change their attitudes when people started, myself and various other people I knew, started to question them and say, just look, you know, just what is this bollocks you're talking about? You know, they were trotting out these really unthinking concepts and not really, if you like, applying them to people's actual lives. So there's one guy I quote in Querying a Culture, a ceremonial magician called Gareth Knight, and he stated very boldly in one of his books on Kabbalah that, let me see, what is it? Homosexuality, like drugs, is a technique of black magic and a perversion and evil.
I actually have another quote from this idiot that I pulled out of your book about how homosexual people aren't human. Like, it's fucking disgusting.
Yeah, that's a different idiot. But again, that shows you how prevalent those ideas were at the time. Yeah, homosexual people are not human. They're kind of like, I guess the modern term would be walk-ins, you know, human beings inhabited by a non-human soul. And this ridiculous idea that if you look at them, it'll damage your aura. You know, if you look at the aura of a homosexual person, it can damage your third eye. I mean, how ridiculous is this stuff? You know,
right? Like, I can't believe that anybody would not throw that book out the window, right? Like,
yeah. But you know, these are the views that people held, and I largely do believe that because they'd never encountered anybody who was a queer occultist, that they could hold on to those views. Another important element was queer pagan camp, which again I talk about in the book. And there's a memoir essay at the start of the book by one of the founders of queer pagan camp, Lou Hart. And queer pagan camp is set up by queer pagans and magicians as a kind of safe space away from all this bollocks. And it started, I think the first camp was in about 1998 or something like that. And it lasted for about 10 years. And I think that helped shape people's attitudes a lot. And then you get, I think also we started to see more, if you like, more queer pagan inflected work coming out of America. And I think America is very, you know, got a very much different approach to this than the British had. Initially, there was a lot of reserve. I think, again, I've quoted the Farrars in saying, oh, well, you know, it's okay if a group of women want to work together, but you know, if a group of men want to work together, we don't really like that. And I think they changed their attitudes, as did several other, if you like, high profile authors in the British witchcraft and occult scene. And they started to realize, well, you know, people are doing this stuff, and we have to kind of like reorient ourselves towards it, or almost kind of like change our attitudes. And I think the books that started to come out from America obviously influenced the British scene as well.
Okay.
So it's kind of, it would be interesting to kind of like look at that process as a, if you like, as a historical phenomenon, there would be a very good PhD in there somewhere, I think. But that's not really what I wanted to do with this book. This book is my own reflections on the various traditions and practices that I've been involved with, and if you like, critiquing them from a queer perspective. But it would be interesting to do a history of just how attitudes shifted in the British occult scene.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. So in Queering Occultures, you address queering and queering, paganisms, tantras, histories. I'm hoping that we can kind of take a little bit of a look at these three topics, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, well, if we take queering paganisms first, I use the term paganisms because I don't see paganism as a, if you like, a single thing. It's obviously, it's a multiplicity of perspectives. And the essays in that section are me looking at various, if you like, popular tropes within paganism. So, for example, there's two essays on Pan.
Io Pan.
Yeah. I see Pan as a very queer deity. And something I got interested in a few years ago was how Pan is used in, particularly in Edwardian literature, as a, if you like, as a signifier of a kind of like a queer desire and also a queer disruption of the normal. So that's where those essays came from. And in looking at that, I wanted to look at how Pan appeared in various social and historical contexts as a, very much as a disruptive figure. So the first essay is about Pan being rediscovered in 18th century Naples, this statue that was dug out of the ground of Pan copulating with a she-goat, and how that changed people's ideas about the ancient Greeks and Romans, and also the, you know, the popularity of erotic sculpture, if you like, and how the authorities tried to deal with that, which I think is an interesting topic in itself.
Sure, yeah.
The other Pan essay, I'm just flicking through the book, is it's a look at Pan within early 20th century literature, and in particular one story by H.H. Munro, who was wrote under the pen name Sarki. I don't know if you're familiar with Sarki, but he's a very kind of like queer author. And I wanted to specifically look at this one story, The Music on the Hill, and not only look at how Pan is represented with that story, but how there are kind of like, if you like, hidden queer themes within it as well. And that's an ongoing project. I keep hoping that if I can stick with that Pan project for enough time, I might one day have enough essays to write a whole, do a whole collection of Pan analysis of Pan's, as I say, as this immensely queer figure appearing in various kinds of literatures as a disruptive influence and an influence of desire. Those are the two Pan essays. And then we've got queer pagans or queering paganisms. I want you to look specifically here at what happens when we put queer and pagan together. And not so much queer as an umbrella term for, if you like, non-normative sexualities, but queer signifying, if you like, a radical process of disruption, of queering as a way of questioning or disrupting the normal.
Hell yeah.
And in that particular essay, I'm looking at the idea of tradition and asking the question of, well, is queer paganism a tradition? And if so, how does that tradition operate? Because I see that as, if queer paganism is a tradition, I see it as something very different to how we normally think of traditions. So I'm one of the things I'm looking at in that essay is the idea of a tradition not being, if you like, defined by a group of authors, but something that's passed around, or even something that only emerges where when a group of queer people get together to frolic and have a good time.
Yeah, I love that.
And then moving on, we've got, I've done an essay on Crossbones, subtitled Queering Sacred Space. Now, Crossbones Graveyard is a very interesting place. It's near one of London's major railway stations, and it's It's a graveyard for mostly sex workers and other people who are kind of like, again, on the margins of culture. And the place was kind of discovered by John Constable, who's a kind of like modern day shamanic figure. And he started holding regular gatherings outside Crossbones. And that, I say, deals with those gatherings and how Crossbones is a really kind of like, it's a tenuous sacred space. You know, we tend to think of sacred spaces as fixed places on the landscape. But again, I think Crossbones kind of challenges that because it's very much an urban space. It doesn't have that, you know, that qu kind of quiet holiness we associate with places like Avebury or Stonehenge. You know, there's trains rattling around it all the time, and it's very much a tenuous space, but interesting nonetheless. And then moving on, the next essay is on querying deity, and that is a kind of short critique of the way that deities tend to get conceptualized. There's a kind of tendency I feel in a lot of modern pagan books to reduce deities to kind of like almost like, well, what does this deity do? Or what can this deity do for me? It's a very kind of like functional approach. And again, I'm kind of criticizing that and saying, well, you know, there's more to deities just than what they can do for us.
Sure.
Then there's an essay on Baphomet, which is a kind of continuation of that thing. And what I'm particularly interested in there is the way that Baphomet has been set up as this transgressive figure that, yes, it's a queer deity, but it's also got a kind of like a machismo associated with it. Or you have to be really hardcore to invoke Baphomet. You know, it's not for the faint-hearted. I started playing around with that and thinking, well, you know, what would a Baphomet that was made of flowers look like? Specifically, a pansy Baphomet. Or, because this goes back to an essay that actually isn't in this book. It's in another collection I did a couple of years ago, and it was at queer pagan camp, and we did a I did a possession of Baphomet, and what emerged was not so much a single entity, but a kind of if you like a hive entity made out of a variety of forms. So it was animal, human, cybernetic. It didn't have a single identity or perspective. It was a morass of things. And again, I want you to play with that idea of the queer monster, if you like, and how that very queering collapses the various binaries that we tend to structure our experience by.
Yeah, I really love that. Exploring how some of these deities have been conceptualized in the past, like really sort of underlines like how different our conception of gender is in our modern culture versus how it has been different in the past. And yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah. There's some kind of different pieces. There's a biography of a kiss, which is very autobiographical. It's about the first time I was kissed in public by another man. It was after I'd been down to a Wiccan coven for a ritual, the details of which escaped me. But what I do remember is going to this quite busy train station the next morning and being kissed on the lips by another man as we leant, you know, I leant out of the train window and he leaned in and kissed me. That was the first time I'd been, as I say, kissed in public by another man on a busy train
I'm
station.
imagining this scene, and this is like the most adorable thing I can imagine. The kiss out of the train window is like a great romantic staple there. I love it.
Yeah, but and I actually met this guy, you know, 25 years later or so. We had a conversation. We you know, we'd kind of like become estranged from each other. We had a kind of awkward conversation. I went home and wrote this piece and then just collapsed in tears. So that's a very kind of like autobiographical piece. Then there's Boner Shamans, which is my attempt to at a bit of queer humor. Boner Shamans is a riff on Round the Horn, which is a very popular British weekly radio comedy that aired in the 1960s, and in fact is still airing today. And Round the Horn was very, very popular, and two of its main characters were two outrageously camp, out of work gay actors. And they use this lingua franca, Polari. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not sure that.
Okay, it was very much a British phenomena. It was a kind of slang code that had evolved over a number of years, and was used by gay men mostly, so that they could talk about things that interested them without heterosexual people catching on.
Okay.
So you've got this strange melange of terminology, like bold. I mean, to be bold is to be shameless or outrageous, but it's also an indication of a preference for homosexuality. So saying, oh, isn't he bold? It's a double entendre, if you like, saying that somebody is outrageous and shameless, but also possibly gay. And then you've got boner, which is an adjective for good. Or you get reverse, lallies, legs, lattie, a house or a flat, polari, to talk, poloni, which could either be used to indicate a woman or a camp man. Julian Sandy would use these terms quite openly during the radio shows, and the audience, I think, knew that or suspected that naughty things were being discussed, but unless they were homosexuals themselves, they wouldn't really understand what they were talking about. So in this, in my own tribute to Julian and Sandy, Boner Sharmans, I'm taking on the character of Kenneth Horne, who was quite literally the straight man who would go and see Julian and Sandy in whatever enterprise they were running. And he would inevitably start off by saying, hello, is anybody there? And they say, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy. And things would degenerate from there. So that's a bit of, kind of, if you like, queer humor, if you like.
I love that. Did any of those terms end up making their way into the broader popular culture in Britain?
Not really, because some of those terms were used in, if you like, very much in theatre land. There's a very good history of polari that goes into where a lot of the terms came from. Some of them were used, like, by dock workers or sailors. You do tend to find some of them, I think trade is possibly one of the most words that's well understood now. I mean, trade generally denotes casual sex, and I think that word has perhaps become more popular. Or to troll, which is to walk around, particularly with the aim of picking up a bit of trade.
Okay, so trade is a noun. Okay.
So it's a quite different meaning nowadays.
yes, with the internet culture, unfortunately.
Yeah. So what else have we got? I've done the pan essays. I think that's all of queering paganism, pretty much. So then moving on to queering tantra. This is perhaps the hardest section, because I'm not necessarily saying that tantra is itself queer friendly, but as a concept, I see it as very queer because of its excessiveness. It has a kind of like a joyfulness attached to it, which I think doesn't really make it unless you're a practitioner. It can be hard to discuss. So the first essay looks at the concept of heteronormativity and how that's applied to tantra, if you like. And again, I'm critiquing a lot of the, if you like, the popular explanations of tantra and how that gets wound into, if you like, to support a heteronormative perspective. So again, when I was first getting interested in tantra in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of the books, if you like, the popular books, particularly those of the sacred sex genre, were again very heteronormative or even quite openly homophobic. So again, I'm talking about that and looking at how concepts like polarity were also kind of like present in those type of texts. Then there's an essay called Ardnarishvara and Other Conundrums of Gender. And this is looking at the whole idea of queer deities from a tantric perspective. And Ardnarishvara is a vertical hermaphrodite. Half of the figure is male and half of the figure is female. What I'm doing is looking at how that figure, the Lord who is half woman, is a good translation of the name, reflects, if you like, Indian rather than Western ideas of androgyny, and how I think the problem for me is that when people start to look at, if you like, Indian deities, they tend to do so quite normally, I think, by applying Western concepts of gender to them. And what I'm arguing in that particular essay is that if we really want to understand what figures like Ardnarishvara are about, we need to look at actually Indian concepts of gender and sexuality, and not overcode them with our own.
Sure, yeah.
And the third essay, Multiple Becomings, Tantric Theologies of the Grotesque, it's a kind of collision between, if you like, continental philosophy and various scenes from a tantric perspective. That's quite a difficult essay, I admit, and the original was much longer, but I tried to cut it down for the book. And again, what I'm doing there is looking at a couple of examples, such as Karaikal Amayar, a devotee, a female devotee of Shiva from about the 6th or 7th century, and how she transforms through her devotion to Shiva, she transforms into a ghoul. She, if you like, she goes from a devoted wife to a ghoul-like devotee. I'm looking at the implications of that. And also a brief look at the Aghori sect, or a modern sect of sadhus, who they do a lot of work with people who are kind of like, again, on the boundaries of Indian culture. So they work directly with people who suffer from leprosy, who have got or have got HIV. And again, I think that's very interesting because they work directly with the concept of abhorrence or liminality, and they see that their practice is a kind of radical transformation. So that's the Queering Tantra section. Then moving on to the last section, it's a bit of a hodgepodge, I must admit. The first essay is called Tracing Lives. What I'm doing there is I'm looking at Aleister Crowley in Berlin and his contact, if you like, with some queer luminaries like Christopher Isherwood. So that's a very short piece because I'd recently come back from Berlin, and I got into a conversation with one of my friends about Crowley in Berlin and Crowley's kind of like notability on the queer scene and how he appears in various novels and short stories as this rather dubious figure. And then there's three essays on shamanism, and what I'm doing there is looking at, if you like, initial contacts between Europeans and shamans, and particularly people who are seen as gender variants, and again how those if you like those contacts shaped, if you like, Europeans' understanding of queerness and sexuality. Then there's an essay on reincarnation and Uranian souls in the 19th century. And again, this reflects one of my interests because it often seems to me that a lot of occult representations of gender and sexuality come out of the 19th century. So in that particular essay, I'm looking at how reincarnation and the evolution, if you like, of the evolved soul became intertwined with ideas of gender and sexuality. Like, for example, Susan E. Gay, very appropriate name, who said that souls reincarnate in both male and female bodies and gradually, if you like, acquire the best quality of each sex. She said that manly men or womanly women with the least developed of souls. And she envisaged that, if you like, the spiritual person as being a blend of the best qualities of both the men and women. So that's a kind of interesting, again, critique of this hard concept of polarity. So there's a little bit more about that. And then continuing with the theme of polarity, the next essay, I'm looking at the early development of this very concept of polarity and tracing that back to, if you like, 18th century science, and then into 19th century ideas about spiritualism and how spiritualism affected people's ideas of gender and sexuality. And looking at some of the 19th century science that basically said that women were inferior to men. So I've got a quote from, if you like, an early psychologist, Gustav Le Bon, who says, in the most intelligent races, as amongst the Parisians, there are a large number of women whose brains are closer in size to those of gorillas than to the most developed male brains. This inferiority is so obvious that no one can contest it for a moment. Only its degree is worth discussion.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
This is how science was used to bolster up this idea of polarity. You also get, you know, scientists of the time saying, oh, well, women shouldn't have the vote because it'll strain their brains too much.
Honestly, Phil, there's people here in my country, women here in my country, saying that shit now. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. And again, it was argued that because the human body had a finite supply of energy, if women were educated, it would place them under mental strain that wouldn't do them any good. So this is interesting, I think, for people who are kind of like trying to kick against this, you know, this still quite popular idea of gender polarity in occultism, because it shows how that idea first emerged out of 18th century science and then was deployed as an argument against women getting the vote or being educated. Mm. And then there's a short essay on masks, mask culture in the 18th century, and how masked balls first became popular in London and how they were associated with sexual depravity. And then the final essay, this was actually something I wrote a very long time ago, back in 1993. This is Bombs in Brigantia. Now, I should explain this, that this is me being slightly naughty, because at the time I wrote it, the idea of Celtic shamanism was very popular in Britain, and there were a lot of books and various people going around doing Celtic shamanic workshops. And this is me being slightly naughty about this and looking at, if you like, ritual homosexuality amongst the Celts and amongst the Norse population. It's quite an old essay, and I dare say some of it is quite dated now, if not completely wrong, but I just thought I'd stick it in there. More as a laugh of anything else. So that's the book. I should also mention there's a very erudite foreword by Patricia McCormack. She's a professor of continental philosophy at Cambridge University, a dear friend of mine. Whenever I read that foreword, I just think she makes me far more erudite and learned than I actually am. And there's another essay by a friend of mine called Queer Pagan Camp, Flyaway Big Black Crows. This is Lou Hart, who's one of the founders of Queer Pagan Camp. And when I was sharing, if you like, early proof copies of Queering Cultures with various friends, one of them said to me, well, look, you keep talking about this thing called Queer Pagan Camp. You need to have some kind of explanatory thing in it. So I asked Lou to do that essay, and I think it's a really lovely, very personal memoir of what it was like at Queer Pagan Camp. I should also mention the cover, which is by my partner, Maria, Two Snails Embracing. I chose that because snails are, if you like, queer animals. They're, you know, they can change sex, they're hermaphroditic. And I wanted to get away from any kind of all the usual occult tropes of, you know, pentagrams and sexual symbols and all the rest of it. And I wanted to use that cover even before I was sure what the book was going to be about. So that's really it in a nutshell.
I love it. Well, thank you. So where can listeners find this book?
I'll send you the link, but you can order it direct from Original Falcon Publications. Ask your local bookshop to stock it. That would be very nice. Or it's available through Amazon.
All right, fantastic. So the other thing that we were hoping to talk about today was the other collection that you have out, Acts of Magical Resistance. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, well, this little collection came out of nowhere, really. It wasn't on my planned list of books to write this year. But what happened was, back in February, Patricia McCormack and I did a little kind of like presentation in London called Queering Chaos Magic. Patricia mostly did the Queering Chaos Magic stuff, which was interesting. But what I did was a kind of a run through of, if you like, magical political activism that I've been engaged with over the past 4 decades or so. And I was discussing that with various people afterwards, and people were saying, well, you know, we don't know about this stuff. Why isn't there anything written about it? And I looked around and I found, yes, there's a great deal written about, you know, various North American acts of magical resistance, but comparatively little written about what's going on in Britain. So that kind of gave me the idea of just putting together this short collection. So there's a kind of like a general introduction where I'm talking about the intersection between magic and politics. And again, when I first became interested in the occult in the late 70s, just as being queer wasn't very widely accepted, if at all, using magic for a political aim was also thought to be quite beyond the pale. In fact, it was, you know, again, it was a kind of influence from Dion Fortune that if you brought magic and politics together, it was A, a bad idea, and B, a sign that you were possibly on the left-hand path.
Whoa. You know, interesting, but coming from a person who, you know, organized their own magical resistance against the Nazis, if I recall correctly, right?
I'm not sure whether she did. I mean, there's an old saw about witches getting together to organize resistance against the Nazis. Whether that actually happened, I have no idea. Okay. I haven't read the literature. Dior Fortune, well, I'm not sure about that story. I've heard about it, but it seems dubious to me, because she makes it quite clear in a couple of her books that magic and politics should not be mixed together. So the introduction is just me sort of like waffling on about that. And then, yeah, here's the quote from Neil Fortune. This is from Sane Occultism. She says, "It may be argued that the occultist with his deeper insight into the natural is the natural leader of reform and should bear his part in social movements. I reply, let him be active in humanitarian efforts by all means, but let him flee any interference in politics as he would the devil. For the experience of centuries has shown that it leads to nothing but trouble." And in Psychic Self-Defense, written about in the next year in 1930, she says, "I personally am of the opinion that any occult fraternity is extremely ill-advised to concern itself with politics for reasons that I've just stated, as I've just said, and which I will not enter into now." And throughout Psychic Self-Defense, she makes various digs at occult fraternities that she views as having become involved in subversive politics. And she characterizes those magical organizations as being of dubious whiteness.
Yes.
So I think largely yes. She's not in favor of people meddling with politics from a magical point of view. And again, that was something that was very prevalent in my experience as a fledgling magician, if you like.
I think with her, we definitely see somebody who's talking from like a position of privilege and wanting to keep the status quo of their privilege intact, I think. And it's gross, so yes.
I find her very weird. But I won't
She's got a lot of pretty gross things to say about a lot of groups of people that I find unwelcome.
She's very homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't go into that here. I think I might have talked about that a little bit in Querying a Culture. So this first essay is a kind of a very basic and brief rundown through some of the magical activisms that I either found out about or was engaged in. So I talk about Greenham Common a little bit, which is obviously the first and probably the best known British event. Then there's Pagans Against Nukes, who were very active in the early 80s. And have their own magazine and their own little network of people. They were protesting the presence of American nuclear weapons in Britain. Then there were things like Stop the City, which was a kind of anarchist festival. And some friends of mine who were magicians were involved in that. And I talk about that briefly. And then there was Pagan Link, which was a decentralized pagan network. A lot of the activists in Pagan Link were very much into the idea of bringing politics and magic together. And it was through Pagan Link that people started to do mass rituals, which I talk about in the book as well. And here's something that Rich Westwood, who was one of the founders of Pagan Link, is saying. He says, By declaring ourselves pagan, we have stepped out of the mainstream of society and to a certain extent put ourselves on the line both materially and spiritually. We maybe need to take the lead from such as pagans against nukes or pagan animal rights, or from the political paganism described in Starhawk's Dreaming the Dark. Or are we content to be spare bedroom witches? We have to take our internal knowings and manifest them. We cannot sit on the fence, for soon they will replace it with razor wire, and then it won't be quite so comfortable. And that was a kind of a clarion call for me, because I thought, yeah, he's absolutely right. No, the 1980s was a very repressive period in British politics, where, like nowadays, we have an extremely repressive Conservative government in power who are very much cracking down on people's freedom and rights in various ways, quite like nowadays, in fact. And pagan link Foster, I think, was a key component in fostering, if you like, a new generation of pagans who were politically active. And then there's the road protest movement, which occurred in the 1990s. And the major players there was a group called the Dragon Environmental Network. And they came up with a different concept, quite independently, I think, of anybody else, of eco magic. So I talk about the Dragon Network a little bit. They did mass rituals, if you like, but they also directly supported people who were protesting the road building movement. So they went and they'd do things like they'd go to a protest and they'd tie talismans on barbed wire or spray paint sigils on the back of bulldozers or live in camps. Because to try and explain it, people were actually blocking the sites that the government were proposing to build roads from by going and putting camps there, and people lived for months on these campsites, you know, getting harassed by the police and bailiffs. The Dragon people supported them. So this essay is a kind of a movement through various events that happened in the UK across the 1990s and into the fairly recent contemporary period, with people protesting against fracking and things like that. Then there's a little bit on queer magical activism, of which there's not a great deal in the Britain, but I have mentioned Leo Martello, who wrote several books on witchcraft and was also a member of the great gay liberation movement in America and was at Stonewall. I also found a very interesting thing in the archive about the Los Angeles Gay Liberation Front trying to levitate a police precinct in 1970, which I think is absolutely amazing.
Yes, it's a great story.
And again, I've talked a little bit about queer pagan camp and how QPC was politically active in various ways. Some lessons I learned from being involved in the British squat scene, which is people illegally taking over unoccupied buildings and living in them, sometimes creating squat cafes, even squat cinemas, the kind of lessons I learned from them, which I think are useful for people to bear in mind. Then there's a little section looking at various types of magical activism, such as mass rituals and how they can be beneficial, a curse against institutions rather than people, doing supportive work. And one of my examples here is I went to visit some friends who were involved in ecological activism. And they wanted some kind of magical support for their work. And so we had a big discussion. And they said, well, you know, we often bat ideas about, but we don't. Sometimes, you know, these discussions peter out, and we could use something to help us focus our ideas. So we came up with this idea of creating a chaos servitor and put it in a teapot. And when the tea was poured, that activated the servitor. And the idea was it would help generate creative ideas and help people agree with each other, or at least not argue too much. That's a kind of supportive action. And then there's a couple of examples of a couple of rituals, one of which is a anger-raising ritual. And many years ago, I was involved in this project called the Children of Gaia. And what we were trying to do was to develop, if you like, a new approach to eco magic, where we wanted to get away from the, you know, the classic five elements of water, earth, air, space, and look at it from a kind of like James Lovelock Gaia perspective. So instead of earth, we had the goddess Letha from the Letha sphere, Hydra from the Hydra sphere, Atma, the atmosphere, and Baia, the goddess of the biosphere. They're kind of like a Gaia-centered four goddesses, if you like, or ecosystems. So the Earth Surge is an anger-raising ritual. And then there's a description of an anti-queer bashing ritual that I did with some friends in 1989 called Unleashing the Furies.
Hmm.
Then there's a short look at, if you like, what I've called protest as spectacle, which is magical protest that doesn't actually look like a protest. It's kind of, if you like, playful street theatre. And one of the examples I've used is some friends of mine who've come up with some stickers. I don't know if you have the whole sticker phenomena where you are in the States, but over here, it's become quite a popular form of political protest. People stick stickers everywhere. And quite often these are used by right-wing groups. And what they'll do is they'll put stickers everywhere saying, this is a Muslim-free zone, or this is a whites-only zone.
Yeah, gross.
Some crap like that. These friends of mine, Phil and Layla Lagarde, have come up with you are now entering a pan control zone. and the little stickers saying things like, frolic naked in the streets, cast spells in the woods, grow vegetables on reclaimed land, imbibe wine and mushrooms, play music in the loop to the luminaries, make love in fields. And they're sticking these stickers all over the place. I think that's an absolutely brilliant idea.
I love that. Yeah, that's great.
Then there's a short essay on wonder. And wonder is something that has very much come out of my own personal practice, and in particular my tantric practice. And that's on wonder as a kind of, as a different perspective, really, to the kind of the urge to order things or to categorize things or to look at things purely in terms of purpose. It's about, you know, making a space for creativity in your life, or making a space just to enjoy the world as it is, which I think is very necessary, particularly if you're involved in activism. You can get burnt out really quickly. So that's that. And then the last section, because I still encounter people who say, oh, you know, magic and politics shouldn't mix. In fact, I recently turned down somebody who wanted to interview me about queeringer cultures because they said, oh, I don't want to bring politics into it. Can we discuss your book in a non-political way? And I was like, no, not going to happen.
That's going to be kind of hard, friend.
That's going to be kind of hard, since I start off with, you know, Roe versus Wade and carry on from there. So I thought I'd look into history, you know, further back than the 20th and 21st century, and look at, if you like, some of our magical ancestors. And how they were involved in politics at the time. So it's a little romp through various people, mostly women, I have to say, who were involved in political activism of one kind or another, like Anna Bonus Kingsford, who was a very famous 19th century occultist, who, according to her biographer, attempted to carry out a magical attack against Louis Pasteur because she was violently opposed to vivisection.
Mm.
Or Florence Farr, who was a, you know, quite apart from being a major figure in the Golden Dawn, was very much into women's suffrage, and actually says that the vote will have to be taken by force, not given. That's what makes it worth having.
Mm.
And Annie Besant, of course, who was a major player in the Theosophical movement, who was known in the early part of her life as Red in Annie Besant because of her involvement with the National Secular Society and various reform movements. And she was actually arrested at one point for distributing a pamphlet on birth control.
Hmm.
So it's just a little, it's not really a kind of like how to do this stuff, but it's a kind of like, it's more like, well, this is what people have done in the past. If you're interested in magical activism, you just might find it useful. But it's not really a kind of like, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three, kind of, you know, how to do it book, but more of a book that I hope will inspire people. And there's a bunch of books. There's a book list of dealing with various subjects. And I've listed all the people who very nicely allowed me to quote from their work or use their images in the back of the book. And that's it.
Yeah, both of the books have extensive bibliographies and places where readers can find more information too, which I really appreciated.
Well, again, I think that's important to do because when I must admit, when I first started writing occult material, I was terrible at providing, sources. And as I've got older, I've began to see the benefit of doing that because I think people are generally interested in finding out what certainly the things that have inspired me. And I'd like people to go and read those works. Contact those other people and be inspired themselves. So I think it's very important to provide good source material because people can say, okay, he's got the idea from that, and they can go and read the book themselves or go and visit the person's website,
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious. So I've heard some folks say that they're of the opinion that just the act of participating in magic in and of itself is a sort of act of resistance. Do you find yourself to be in that camp?
It can be, but it very much depends on where you're coming from and what you do with it. I'm not sure that just because a lot, as I've said, a lot of magicians still today are of the opinion that, politics shouldn't mix. There are still a lot of people out there who don't understand why queer people would want to go off and create their own space. So I think it very much depends on what you do and what your, if you like, where your ethics lie.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. For people wondering how they might go about querying and perhaps queering their own practices, their own cultures, their own occultures, do you have any thoughts along those lines about, how people might be able to proceed?
Well, as I said, I see querying as, if you like, a mode of critique or a way of questioning concepts that we perhaps otherwise might not do. And my own personal engagement with this was because when I encountered all this homophobic rubbish in a lot of occult books, it struck me gradually that, something occultists are very prey to is delivering opinions and perspectives, not merely as, oh, this is what I think, but this is occult truth. This is occult truth that descends from the higher planes or the inner plane
The
masters,
secret
and you can't
masters told
question
me.
it. You absolutely can't question it. And this is why people like Gareth Knight are able to say with utter confidence, oh, homosexuality is a technique of black magic and a perversion and it's evil. He's stating a fact. He's not giving you an opinion. It's an absolute fact. And I started to think, well, if they're wrong about queerness, if they're wrong about homosexuality, what else are they wrong about? And I began to see, finally, in my own work, a tendency to interrogate, if you like, occult concepts and tropes that I'd kind of absorbed and not really reflected on. So, the occult homophobia and really strange theories of gender kind of like really struck out for me. For other people, it might be the racial bias that you find in a lot of 20th century occult writings. For me, the querying practice to say, well, let's take things that we've perhaps not really thought about and look at them from another angle. It's similar with what I was saying about rather than applying Western concepts of gender to non-Western deities, try and look at how that culture conceptualizes gender instead. Don't uncritically apply our own bias to things, but look at them from a different perspective. And I think that would be a good start for people to actually question perhaps ideas that they've not really thought about or just accepted and thinking, okay, well, how does this concept shift when we look at it from another angle?
Absolutely.
I mean, a very simple idea is the binary oppositions that you get in a lot of occult texts, kind of like where men and women are separate and up and down, and the spiritual versus material, and those concepts tend to get reified rather than treated as, if you like, things that evolved over time. And I think that very binary distinction needs to get we need to move away from it. It's like I know I've got some queer pagan friends in the States who still use the concept of polarity. They've accommodated themselves to it, which is fine for them. But equally, there are a lot of people I know who've just gone, that's not a concept that works for me. I don't have anything to do with it anymore. It's just not there. It's no longer an eternal part of the cosmos for them. Things just don't work like that. So I think questioning not only theories, but your own ideas, I think that's always a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. So Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. Is there anything that you would like to discuss that I haven't asked you about yet? Or do you have any questions you'd like to ask me?
I can't think of anything offhand, I'm sorry to say. I think I probably rabbited on quite enough.
No, this was fantastic. I would keep you for longer. I don't want to monopolize all of your time, though. Where can listeners find the work that you've been talking about and your work in general?
Most of my books were available from Original Falcon Publications. That's my first book, Condensed Chaos. Second book, Prime Chaos. They're both books on chaos magic, which I haven't really engaged with for about a quarter of a century now. They're kind of early works. The Pseudonomicon, which is a little book looking at Lovecraftian magic.
It's very fun. I love it. Yes.
And then there's Heinz Varieties, which is an anthology of my writings in different occult spaces over the past 40 years. It's a kind of like either a best of or a worst of.
I love it personally.
That one and the new one, Querying Occultures, they're all available from Falcon, or you can buy them on Amazon, or you can pester your local occult bookshop to stock them. That would be great. My own self-published work you can find on Amazon, but the best place to go is to my blog, enfolding.org. It's http://enfolding.org. And there's a page there that lists my self-published works, because a few years ago I started an imprint called Twisted Trunk, which is mainly publishing translations of tantric texts. We've done, apart from Acts of Magical Resistance, which actually isn't up there yet, I must get around to doing that, I've published two books by Mike Magee, who is a very well-known writer on the subject of the tantras, and he has spent much of his life translating various obscure tantric texts. And we've done two books together so far. One is called Yakshini Magic, and it's about Yakshinis, who are kind of female forest spirits, and the rituals to form a relationship with them in order to get them to do things for you. The other one is called Kali Magic, and that's a collection of essays and translations of texts dealing with the goddess Kali.
Hmm.
Both of which I published through Amazon. Acts of Magical Resistance will be up there as well. But I'll send you links and everything, and I'll send you links to my Twitter feed and my Mastodon profile and anything else I can think of.
All right, fantastic. Thank you so much. So, Phil, do you have any last thoughts or anything that you'd like to leave us with to ponder?
Not really, just thanks for listening and thanks for having me on your podcast. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And next time you have a new collection out, I would love to discuss it with you if you're interested.
Okay, well, I'm always open to coming on again and waffling. You know.
Okay, no fantastic. Well, that would be great.
3, 2, 2, 4.
All right, fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Phil Hine. You can check out Querying Occultures and many of his other books available at Original Falcon Publications. Acts of Magical Resistance is available on Amazon, and you can read Phil's blog at enfolding.org. Check the show notes for links to those and more of Phil's stuff. If you're looking for some inspiration, I would encourage people to check out Querying Occultures as well as Acts of Magical Resistance, or books like them, which invite the reader to question what one is up to and what is being said, to query in general. I feel like it's important to think critically about what we do in our practices if what we're actually attempting to do is to create more agency for ourselves. Without this critical, pardon the pun, component, we might simply be reinforcing or recreating in miniature the same systems which we might be attempting to confront or to move away from. Using critical thinking means placing some authority back in your own hands, you're not just passively absorbing information from a book or other source. A lot of us have sort of been conditioned to do this. The educational system is one variable in this equation, but there are others. The way that our cognition functions and how we learn could be a part of this too. I mean, given that things like hypnosis are possible. Regardless, best not to just believe right away what you read or hear or think in your own head. Ask questions. Challenge that shit. There will likely be very few simple answers to be found, and that's okay. But there is one simple answer, and that is to the question of where you can find some other great podcasts to listen to. Check out the other awesome shows available on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We've got Administrism, Grognostics, Primordia, Ad Hoc History, Smuts Up, Unearthing Paranormalcy, and XV Planis. All kinds of great shit there. There's lots of exciting stuff happening with the Green Mushroom Project, which is a large-scale group working that you can be a part of. This thing is focused on, among other things, fostering creative and magical practice and strengthening our position against hate groups within the occult community through solidarity. Check out greenmushroomproject.com for more info about that. We've been working on putting together some tech for a while now that we're pretty excited to share. It's a new take on some old classics that we hope people will enjoy. Big thanks to Dave, Laughing Dog, Shane, Mindbender, and everybody who's been helping out with the beta reading in that process. The digital mixtape is still in the works and is set to be released on Halloween, which is also the project's birthday. Shout out to Keats Ross and the Wheel of Hollowed Antarctic Occult Artists Collective, our partners on this project. Many thanks to everybody who's contributed occult and esoteric audio tracks to that. There's some very cool stuff. The bumper music you've been hearing in this episode is one that I produced. We have a bunch of other things associated with the Green Mushroom Project going on. There's a tarot club, a book club, a bibliomancy experiment in which we are discovering the project's scripture and conducting exegesis. All kinds of stuff going on. The sibling project that we've got, Administrism, has some very cool parapsychology experiments happening as well, and that is all organized on the Green Machine Discord server. So I mentioned before the interview that I thought humor and laughter were particularly potent tools for causing change to occur. I've talked a lot about how dangerous satire can be in the past here. But so one great touchstone for this, I think, is Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose, which I certainly recommend. And this is actually one that we enjoyed during our book club together, so that was fucking rad. Anyway, so the spoilers for this book or movie, if you haven't seen or read it, plug your ears. Anyway, the whole grand conspiracy that sees many people killed in the story and countless priceless artifacts go up in flames revolves around keeping what the person at the heart of the conspiracy believes to be a very dangerous idea from getting out. So hidden in the library of the Abbey, where the novel is set, or the movie is set, is the sole surviving copy of the lost second book of Aristotle's Poetics, which is a treatise on comedy. So in the murderer's eyes, this book is super dangerous and subversive and presents a huge existential threat because it elevates comedy to the status of an art form and therefore a subject of serious intellectual inquiry. Since laughter has the subversive quality of being able to challenge authority, this could spell doom for the whole structure of the church and maybe even society itself in the eyes of this murderer. So yeah, it's fun stuff, and I think a great touchstone for the power of laughter and what it might do to society. Perhaps he was right. Okay, so I'd like to share a list from the end of Phil Hines' Acts of Magical Resistance, because I think this is a particularly useful collection of things to consider. And it is actually entitled Points to Consider. So here we are. Be passionate. Be inclusive, make alliances, give options. If you're planning a ritual, allow people to choose how they want to participate. Plan ahead. Multiple or flexible plans are much more effective than expecting that a single plan will survive contact with reality. Things that sound fine in a discussion or on paper may not work out exactly as you envision them. Small steps can be productive. Small actions gather momentum and enthusiasm for larger events. Think before you act. What is the best way to intervene or help in a particular situation? Ask advice. Rotate roles. If one person has the same job to do, they are more likely to burn out or get bored. Rotating jobs is an excellent way of sharing skills and expertise. Know your enemy. Know the law. Learn to work with the media or work the media. Consider non-violent direct action. And ask yourself, what are the ethical implications? All right, fuck yeah. Thank you so much to Phil Hine. So there's the idea of nonviolence and turning the other cheek, which, as far as I can tell, is a sort of hard to parse out thing for modern people. There's a lot of different interpretations of this, like so many other things that we find in the Bible. I was under the impression that it advocated sort of like maybe an irrational, like offering oneself up for maybe like abuse to abusers, right? Like, or, you know, like irrational, complete passivity, perhaps. Which I'm guessing is an interpretation that some people have maybe used to beat others over the head with at times, but I think it's definitely much more complicated than that. Let's see if the religious scholars at Wikipedia can help us parse this out. Okay, so turning the other cheek is a phrase in Christian doctrine from the Sermon on the Mount that refers to responding to insult without retort, says Wikipedia. So this passage is variously interpreted as accepting one's predicament, commanding non-resistance, or advocating Christian pacifism. So it's from the New Testament in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5. So this is an alternative to the eye for an eye that Jesus gives. Here he says, "You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you." So that's from the English Standard Version. So in the Sermon on the Plain, this is in Gospel of Luke chapter 6, this is part of the commanding to love your enemies that Jesus does. He says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. To one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also, and to one who takes away your cloak, do not withdraw your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you, and from one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And as you wish that others would do to you, so do to them." So that is also from the English Standard Version. So according to this interpretation, the passage calls for like total non-resistance to the point of like facilitating aggression against oneself. And since human governments defend themselves by military force, some have advocated for Christian anarchism, including Leo Tolstoy, who elucidated his reasoning in his 1984 book, The Kingdom of God is Within You. So there's some other interpretations of this as well. So Jewish scholars Amy Jill Levine and Mark Brettler state that the issue is about justice after an injury has been committed. Again, this is still from Wikipedia. They argue that since the Greek word used in Matthew for resist refers to like armed resistance or violent struggle, that Jesus is offering to confront violence, to maintain your honor, and to shame the perpetrator instead of escalating violence or losing dignity. By offering the left cheek, the victim resists humiliation by inviting the right-handed jab, which exposes the slap as a violent act that failed to reduce the humanity of this victim, thus challenging the perpetrator and shaming them for the cruelty of their treatment. The scholar Walter Wink, in his book Engaging with Powers, Discernment, and Resistance in a World of Domination, interprets the passage as ways to subvert the power structures of the time. So in his interpretation of it, at the time of Jesus, Wink says, striking a person deemed to be of lower socioeconomic class than oneself by hitting them backhandedly was a means of asserting authority and dominance. if the persecuted person turned the other cheek, the discipliner or whatever would, you know, was faced with a dilemma. The left hand was used for like unclean purposes. So a backhanded strike on the opposite cheek would not be performed. An alternative would be to slap with an open hand as a challenge, or to punch the person, and this was seen as like a statement of equality. So by turning the other cheek, the persecuted person was actually demanding equality. Okay, well, thank you so much to Wikipedia. Fuck yeah. I do like Wink's take on that. I think there's something interesting in using things that might appear sort of passive, like laughter or nonviolent resistance, using these as a sort of like fulcrum, or constructing interesting Trojan horses with them, perhaps, which I think laughter can be good for. The term guerrilla ontology comes to mind here. In addition to the notion that sometimes, from a strategic standpoint, subtlety is sometimes like the best tact, there is also the notion that subtle action is very akin to that which takes place in magic, the way that things can start very small and build up momentum, as Phil talked about, you know, in that list of things to consider. When we look back in history, it's often been the case that one person did actually end up making a difference. A lot of times, the person didn't live long enough to see that difference that they would make. It's kind of a bitter, or maybe hilarious, irony of being a mortal human. But my point is that even if it doesn't seem like you can do anything to like make changes in the world, the evidence is actually very much to the contrary. Keep working for the stuff that's important to you in the world. Keep supporting the causes that you care about. Keep trying, even if it doesn't seem like you're getting very far. Make adjustments, learn from mistakes, take breaks for self-care and for sanity. You just never know what the cumulative effect of your efforts will be, and you may never live to see them. Just looking at history, right? So settle in for the long haul and use your efforts strategically, and keep trying. And don't forget to laugh along the way. The importance of morale cannot be understated. Okay. A couple more final thoughts to share with you all, as well as the Green Mushroom Project statement of resistance. But real quick, I will remind you that if you like the show and you're into what we've got going on here, you can support it on Patreon or buy me a coffee. Thank you so much to the people who are already doing so and making it possible. Thanks also to the people who are supporting the show by spreading the word. I don't have an advertising budget, so the primary way that people will find out about this podcast is through people like you. So tell your friends, and your grandpa's friends. Tell your local telephone booth sanitization agent. Tell your vocal coach, your college sports analyst, your milkman, and your kid's school principal about it. You can also post about it on social media or write a positive review where that is a thing, or give it a rating. So all of this stuff is super helpful. Thank you so much to everybody who is doing that. And yes, don't forget to smash the shit out of that follow button so you can get updates when new episodes come out. You can find Lux Occult, Hello Void, and other merch available at Illumin Industries, which is my Etsy store. Items will be printed on demand using the most eco-friendly options I could find and shipped directly to you at pretty close to cost. Winners of the Cryptography Poetry Contest will be receiving items from there and more. I'm going to save listener mail and shoutouts for next time. Maybe we'll get into some of that crypto poetry dope stuff. Very excited about it. But I wanted to button things up here by mentioning this. There's this famous quote associated with Angela Davis, which is from a letter that James Baldwin wrote to her on November 19th, 1970, as a statement of solidarity with Davis's legal flight. So the quote goes like this: "If they take you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night." So in 1971, Davis goes on to publish If They Come in the Morning, Voices of Resistance, a collection of writing about U.S. legal trials and prisons, which she edited. So this is a whole other interesting, cool story. Why am I bringing it up near the end of the episode like this? Well, I just wanted to say that maybe you feel like there's not a place for you at the table, maybe in like these types of discussions. I've heard quite a few people say things to me like, "But Luxa, I'm just a cishet white dude. I don't think I'm like invited to the party in terms of like supporting these causes that might not be like directly related to me or whatever, even though what I want to do is to help." And I can sort of understand that confusion or discomfort or whatever. And so yeah, if that's you right now, thank you for listening. Listening is a fucking awesome way to start being helpful, right? We can't help out with something unless we can like kind of start to see the edges of it. And when it comes to human rights, it's about fucking humans, right? And we're all humans. There's always going to be a lot more common ground than differences between us when we start looking. So yes, I think that that's a quote that I think about a lot. If they take you in the morning, they'll be coming for us that night, right? So I'm going to go ahead and revisit a quote also that Phil included in Acts of Magical Resistance. He also shared this during the interview. He points out in the book that although a lot of the text hasn't aged well, there's still some inspiring stuff in Westwood's and Walbridge's Awakening the Dragon, like the snippet, which I will truncate. By declaring ourselves pagan, we have stepped out of the mainstream of society, and to a certain extent put ourselves on the line both materially and spiritually. Are we content to be spare bedroom witches? We have to take our internal knowings and manifest them. We can't sit on the fence, for soon, they will replace it with razor wire, and it won't be so comfortable then. Alright, something worth thinking about. I'm gonna take us out with a silly little track that I produced for the Green Mushroom Project and We the Hollow digital mixtape, Fuck Around and Find Out Part 2. But before we do, let me remind you all with the Green Mushroom statement of resistance to resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. All right, fuck yeah. Thank you so much to Phil Hine for joining me today. Thanks to the people out there that are helping to protect civil liberties. Thanks to all the folks who've written the stuff for the crypto poetry contest and for the great analysis that's been conducted there. Very fun. And most of all, thanks to you for listening. Much love. This is Lux Estrada reminding you to stay strong and stay fucking curious. All right, this is Riot Act.
Occult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
Hey, Luxa, what do you have there? It looks like a tattered old Discord server.
Oh, this old thing? It's pretty beat up. But if I do this...
Sweet! Now that you peeled off the outer bits, it looks fresh as hell.
We should call it the Green Machine.
Awesome! I fucking hate it!
That's okay. It should function alright. But it would probably work better if we had more people.
Yeah! We have an awesome crew of chaotists, occultists, socialists, witches, and weirdos, but there's always room for more.
Absolutely. If you'd like to take part in any of our many chats, rituals, workshops, clubs, and more, hit me up and I will send you a link. You can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or at luxoccultpod on Instagram.
And remember, resist.
Welcome to XV Planet. Greetings, friends, fiends, and lovers of strange and wondrous things. My name is Flood, and I am the host of XV Plants, a bi-weekly podcast of the odd and unusual. The Core of Ex Viplanis is a documentary-style exploration into paranormal investigations that I and my ever-evolving group of magical misfits conduct. We take a look at the history, the mystery, then go see it for ourselves, and then we bring that experience, and on occasion, that evidence, to your ears. Alongside the investigations, you'll find a treasure trove of other content, like interviews with authors, art historians, mediums, UFO researchers, cryptid hunters, fellow paranormal investigators, as well as deep dives into the arts, exploring topics like the Killing Joke frontman Jazz Coleman's magical practices, and how that propelled the band forward, and whether or not David Lynch was really conducting occult rituals through Twin Peaks: The Return. So follow XVPlanis today and get caught up on the journey, because I can promise you, it only gets stranger from here. I'll see you on the fifth plane.
Hi, I'm Frater Yarmurud.
And I'm Zarina.
And we'd like to introduce you to administrism.
What is administrism?
As an occultist, for years I felt the universe directing me towards a practice that was ecologically based, with a foundation laid out by cultures untouched by the influence of what's become modern Western society. With labels like shamanism and neo-shamanism carrying too much uncomfortable post-colonial baggage, I've decided to take my own approach.
Join Yara and me as we research and develop a magical system where we recognize our place in nature with all the life that surrounds us. We want to share with you our journey into a paradigm that incorporates ritual and ecology, anthropology and metaphysics, biology, and the occult.
Using ethically sourced material, historical accounts, ethnographic records, and our own personal experience, we want to share our discoveries as we watch administrism grow in an organic blend of traditional spirituality, modern science, and a dash of homesteading, without all the connotations associated with labels like shamanism.
We hope that by listening to how administrism sprouts in us, it will plant its seeds into your own practice. This way, you can find your own balance between magic and nature.
Because the world needs room for both.
And don't forget, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Are you heartbroken? Having trouble letting go of that special someone? Here at Illumin Industries, we understand the complex web of strife and heartache that is mortal existence. That's why we created Forever Friend, a revolutionary advancement in companionship science. Thanks to new changes in the law, it is now possible to transfer someone's digital imprint to one of our specially designed furry friends. Imagine cuddling up at night with a cat or dog that combines the fluffy softness of a Persian and the personality point markers of your ex-fiancé, or the loyalty of a golden retriever with the skill for trivia of your dead husband. Forever Friends are carefully engineered to be hypoallergenic, hyper-enhanced, and gluten-free, allowing for hours of authentic feeling conversation. Conversation mode can be switched off through the Forever Friend app for those times when you'd prefer to be alone with your thoughts. Choose from over 20 breeds of dogs and cats with a variety of color options, with bird options coming soon. The possibilities are endless. Forever Friends, softer than the real thing. Illumin, making it work for you. See Cyber Catalog for details and information about the Forever Friend privacy policy. Illumin Industries and its affiliates reserve the right to change these policies at any time without notice. All conversations with Forever Friends may be recorded for quality control and optimization purposes. Quality of Forever Friends personality emulation is dependent on data richness of digital imprint, not responsible for actions of Forever Friends.